which was titled Sacrifice. Seeing how I didn't get as far as I wanted to in the message last Sunday, so I'm going to continue today. Eventually, I want to get to the point where I want to look at the difference between the Ten Commandments and the greatest commandments. And that's where I'm going to eventually end up at. We're going to be talking about gods and gods. And so I'm going to read a passage of Psalms, and then from Psalms 82. God presides in a great assembly. He renders judgment among the gods. How long will you defend the unjust and show partiality to the wicked? Defend the weak and fatherless. Uphold the cause of the poor and the oppressed. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. The gods know nothing. They understand nothing. They walk about in darkness. All the foundations of the earth are shaken. I say, you are gods. You are all sons of the Most High. But you will die like mere mortals. You will fall like every other ruler. Rise up, O God. Judge the earth, and all the nations are your inheritance. An MG pulled alongside a Rolls Royce at a traffic light. Do you have a phone in that car? His driver asked the guy in the Rolls. Of course I do, replied the haughty deluxe car driver. Well, do you have a fax machine? The driver in the Rolls sighed and said, I have that too. Then do you have a double bed in the back? Said the midget driver, wanting to know. Ashen-faced, the Rolls-Royce driver sped off, and that afternoon he had the mechanic install a double bed in his auto. A week later, the Rolls-Royce driver passed the same MG, which was parked alongside of the road. The back windows were fogged up and steam was pouring out, and the arrogant driver pulled over, got out of his Rolls, and banged on the MG's midget's back window until the driver stuck his head out. I want you to know that I have a double bed installed, bragged the Rolls-Royce driver. The midget MG driver was unimpressed. You got me out of the shower to tell me that? No matter how much we seem to have, we never seem to be able to keep up with the Joneses. We are in a material world. It seems like we compete a lot. Well, maybe not us so much here, but the world in general, I think, competes a lot. And it doesn't matter. There's always somebody has something different than you. That's just the way it is. John Muir wrote this. He was a mountaineer and was called the father of the national parks. Rocks and waters, etc., are words of God, and so are men. We all flow from one fountain soul. All are expressions of one love. God does not appear and flow only through the narrow chinks and round bore wells here and there in favor to races and places. But he flows in a grand, undivided currents, shoreless and boundless over the creeds and forms and all kinds of civilizations and the peoples and the beasts, saturating all and fountainizing all. I think that's a wonderful way to start this message. I see God and God's love flowing over all. This Easter season, we have been looking back through history, human history, and where lived in every culture a group of gods and God, and looking at the shift in the way we think after Jesus walked and talked on this earth. Because no matter how you look at it, Jesus changed the world. There's no question about it. Whether you believe or not, the world has been changed since he's been walked on this earth. And I do believe that he, no matter what I say in this message today, which I'm going to wander around a little bit, and I believe that what Jesus taught was the greatest teachings that we have for humanity. We don't do them the way we should yet, but we're working on them. I think what he taught, love your neighbor as yourself, is yet to be realized in its fullness for sure. Professor Jason Bavines, in a course that I am listening to about thinking about religion, is titled Thinking About Religion and Violence. And he makes the comment that says, we are not that far removed from the violence of gods, the gods of our past. And in the name of God, whether a nation god or a religious god or a culture god or a race god, we of the people of this world have been doing violence to others as long as we've walked this earth in the name of our God. And it hasn't changed. We're still got a ways to go. We still are doing actions in the name of our God. And as I talked about last week, there are small letter G gods, and I consider thoughts that we accept as being God-like forces that walk in energy, that walk and talk in our minds. God thoughts or live in our thoughts and action. No matter what you believe, you have a mountain of thought, and you give light and life to that, and you are your own city on the hill. That several messages back. And we give energy and thought energy to whatever you believe to be true, whatever that is. I wonder if we don't just choose or borrow them for a time. We borrow these ideas and we choose them from time to time. Or do they choose us? That's a question that I think is a philosophical question. It's also a religious idea. But the way I kind of see things sometimes, we're all brought up in a certain way. We are born into a nation, into a race. We are a particular race or religion. And we are brought up in that way of thinking. Every one of us. We have had a childhood in which we have been brought up. So what choice did we have in that respect? We have it's been chosen for us. A phrase that I heard, and which we have heard throughout the years, and I heard it in a movie that I was watching yesterday, the strength of one's convictions. What is the strength of one's conviction? Where does one get the strength of one's conviction? The power of thought can change us for the good or, God forbid, evil. It has the power to do that. Where does it get that power? The power of one's conviction. Now I'm going to step back in time for a while. I'll leave you hanging there for a little bit. I'm going to go back where I kind of pick up where I left off a little bit last week. We were talking about the Mosaic Law and the idea of scapegoating. It was something that I wanted to bring up. It didn't come about. But I also want to recognize something that Jerry has said before I move on. Jerry. And he, that I missed in the message, and he later asked me, and I admitted that I missed it, that the Greeks and the Romans had many gods, but there was one God over top of them all. And that is true. That is true in a lot of, almost every culture. There may have been many gods, but there was one over top of them. There's one of them, and I'm eventually going to get to the idea of one God somewhere down the line here. But I'm going to Start with the idea of scapegoating, which was in the Mosaic law, in which this was before Jesus' time, before Jesus' sacrifice, long in cultures, and it was done in a lot of cultures. Now, I've said last Sunday, we want to look at the Old Testament as a set of way things were done by many, many cultures. It wasn't just the Jewish faith or the Israelite faith. Every culture did it, and everybody had a culture, and everybody came from some nationality, and they did these things that are in the Old Testament law, Mosaic law. So if you want to look for a detailed account of how it was done by many different cultures, you can look in the Mosaic law or in the Old Testament, and you can find that out. It's very, very detailed, how you sacrifice, when you sacrifice, what days you sacrifice to the God that you sacrifice to, which I'm going to get to, and so on. And so one of the ways in which they dealt with sin that was within the community was called a scapegoat. And within the Israelite faith was that you had two goats, and they had a ceremony. I forget the day of the ceremony. Day of Atonement? I forget. There was a certain day in which they did this each year. Because they only asked for forgiveness of sins one day out of the year. And what they would do is they would take two goats, and they would cast lots on the goats, and they would pick the one goat, and they would put the blessings on the goat, and the other ones they would put all the sins and the curses on this goat, and they would send that goat out into the desert to be eaten by the evil god and demon god of the desert. And that's how they would dispose of their sins. The name of the Israelite god was, I will spell for A-Z-A-Z-E-L. I have no idea how to say it. Something. So that was the name of the demon god in which would go out and supposedly eat this goat and devour the sins of the people. And even though we kind of smile and kind of chuckle at it, every culture did it. Every culture did some kind of scapegoating to get rid of your sins before Jesus came and walked on this earth. So, as I said about the course, we're not very far from this type of thinking yet. We still have cultures that think this way in various different ways. It may not... I seen your mouth open. Did you want to say something?
At one sins away made them at one with their God.
Yes, it renewed the relationship to their God. So atonement meaning at one meant. That's a good point. Yes. So it was a way of reestablishing once a year. Now, I know the Russian Orthodox, because I know a gentleman that goes to a Russian Orthodox. And once a year, they go through this type of ceremony also. It's not necessarily goats and all that kind of stuff, but they atone once a year. They go in front of the priest, and they have an atonement ceremony for once a year. His sins are forgiven once a year. And, of course, we had a lot of discussions about all that. But that's still going on today. They have one day a year, and it's usually before their Easter. They have to be made right in order to celebrate their Easter ceremony.
I think I'd have to go a lot more often than that.
You compile them. So you compile them up and then you go once a year.
That'd be a burden. I'd like to get rid of them a little more often than that.
Jesus talks about, when we talk about freedom, that's coming down the road, another message or so, about freedom, freedom in Christ. That's one of don't we sing a song about being free from your burdens and all this kind of stuff? This is what they're referring to. Your burdens are set free. So this idea is still alive and well today. And so even though we are progressive in our thought, we have to be respectful of other people's ways of thinking because this is how they think. We have to, and I'm not going to say they're right or wrong. I believe in Jesus as being the highest teachings. I believe I'm forgiven. I continuously get forgiven. I don't think I have to do a sacrifice and ask for all this. I'm up into the Jesus world a little bit more than the Old Testament. And I get myself into trouble because of that, because I tell some people we don't live in the Old Testament no more. We live in the New Testament. And I'm going to make a big example of that, show an example of that eventually. Another example of sacrifice was Cain and Abel. You can actually go back before that to Adam and Eve, when it says when God put skins of animals on Adam and Eve before they left the garden. That is considered also to be a sacrifice. But I'm not really sure that literally means that the God of the garden went out and killed animals and put skins on them. He said he just took skins of animals or skins and put them on Adam and Eve. So it may be referring to an idea that they were made physical, or the transferring of a soul, of a naked soul without a body, to a soul that had a body. So it gets really, you know, it all depends on how you interpretate a lot of Genesis. And then the next one probably is Cain and Abel, which I've always said that it's two way of thinking. You live in a blessing or you're still looking for a blessing. But another course that I listen to, I usually have one running up on my CD player in the front while I'm driving down the road, and then I have one of my TV running in my DVD player. So when I stop, I listen to that one. When I'm driving, I listen to this one up here. So the other one I'm listening to back in the bunk is, when I stop to eat and do whatever, rest, is Big History. And he referred to that as the Cain and Abel as an end of time, because agriculture and domesticated animals was a really, really big time in the evolution of human history. And so when we went from hunter-gatherers to living off the land or domesticating animals and living off in agriculture, that was a really, really super big step up of humanity, because now we can live in cities in large groups, and it was a really big development. So he says that the Cain and Abel story is about that example. I think that's a very good way of looking at it. That's the beauty of the Bible and the beauty of the text. You can take it and apply it and learn many, many things from it. So I'm going to have to add that to my repertoire of understanding. Noah, what was probably the next one who in the Bible offered sacrifices, and then it was Abraham, and on and on. And now I want to look at the difference between the Ten Commandments and the greatest commandment. And in order for me to, how many people have actually read the Old Testament Ten Commandments recently? Okay, are you familiar what it says? Should I ask that? Are you familiar what it actually says in the Ten Commandments? In the first two, especially? Nobody's. Okay, I'll read it. Because you'll be surprised what it says in there.
What's that?
I'm going to read in Exodus 20. I'll give you a minute. Connie's looking. Exodus 20 is the one I'm going to read. That's the very first account that I know of. And my point in trying to illustrate this is that there is a difference between the Ten Commandments and what Jesus said, by far. And it says, starts out, and God spoke all these words. So you have to understand what God is in the context of what it's reading. We're reading an English text. We're not reading a Hebrew text, which is very, very difficult, because it doesn't, it may use God sometimes, or it uses more Yahweh and Yahweh God a lot of times. Then it says, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself any image in the form of anything in heaven above or in the earth beneath and in the waters below. You shall not bow down to them nor worship them. For I, the Lord your God, which would be Yahweh God, am a jealous God, punishing the children for their sins of the parents to the third and fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing love in 1,000 generations of those who love me and keep my commandments. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. And then the second one is, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days shall thou labor and do all thy work, and on it goes. Now, is that your God? No one is shaking their head either way. Yes, Dan.
That definitely comes back to one God, or there ain't others then.
Okay. Now that you brought that up, the idea that I have is, in which I have put a lot of thought in it, and again, I have to be very careful how I say it because I don't want to offend nobody. I do not think the God of the Israelite people is Jesus, nor is it the God in which we should be worshiping. It is one of many. If you read Deuteronomy, I forgot to mark that, 32:7. Right. You can look that up. You want to follow along. This is one of my major verses that I use to support what I have to say. Remember the days of old. This is the song of Moses. This is about when he's getting ready to die or some along the line. And what was done was they created a song to sing so you would remember the history and the knowledge that you had. It was carried in a song. Same with the Psalms. A lot of times they sang them in order to remember what they were supposed to remember, because you remembered it in a song and you sang it. The congregation sang it. All the people sang it. So this is a song that people would sing. It's real long. I'm only going to read a couple verses. Verse 7. Remember the days of old. Consider the generations long ago. Ask your fathers and he will tell you. Your elders, and they will explain to you, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, and he set up boundaries for the people, according to the number of the sons of Israel. But if you go on down in the Septuagint, it says sons of God. Here again, we're dealing with an English translation of a text that you have to look and study. Next verse, verse 9, clears it up. It says, the Lord's portion, or Yahweh's portion, which is the God of Israel, which is used many times, God of Israel, the God of Israel. It says, the Lord's portion is his people. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. What that means is that Yahweh's portion is Jacob's offspring, which is the 12 tribes of Israel. That was his portion. That was the God of the Israelites that in which they were to adhere to. And that God gave them the Ten Commandments in which they were to adhere to. We as non-Israelite people do not adhere to them. We don't keep the Sabbath, which is Saturday. We don't do that. I am suggesting to you that this also shows that God means a way of thinking. Because Yahweh, God of Israel, was jealous. He did not want them to think in any other way. Do not bring any other thoughts before me. You're replacing any other gods before me? Don't bring no other way of thinking in front of me. I don't want to hear it. I only want to hear what I gave you to say and think and believe and live. And that's it. That's all you're allowed to do. Now, you correct me if I'm wrong, if that's not what the Old Testament God did to the Israelite people. That's exactly what he did. He explicitly gave them instructions not to deviate whatsoever. Dan.
Sounds like he's saying, don't believe in the real God, the one above him.
I'll leave that up to you.
Yeah, your own choice.
I'll get to what Jesus had to say. And the difference in here in a minute. So I want to establish with clarity that the God of the Old Testament was not the God in which we are to adhere to loving Jesus. And Jesus came through a different priesthood along the way. He came through the Melchizedek priesthood. And that was different than the priesthood, the tribe of Judah, the Levitical priesthood. And that's what upset the Jews a lot, because Jesus didn't claim priesthood through their priesthood. And that upset the Jews tremendously. He came through a different God that was above all gods. A name above all names, Jesus said, or I think maybe Paul wrote that. I'm not sure. I should have looked it up. But Jesus was above all names, and eventually he was supposed to be given a power. Jesus is to have power over all humanity. The idea that gods are thoughts that control ourselves cannot be no more clear than what is written and what I somewhat said. Yes, you have to study it. Yes, you have to contemplate on it. Yes, you have to be open to accept the idea. You have to look at it. Daniel says, which is another place that I believe that Daniel is looking towards the future and a time when Jesus is going to come and do away with a lot of these lesser gods and overpower them and become the one over top. I'll get to the one God too. I'm not there yet. And Daniel says in Daniel 7, 11. Now, he's having a vision and he's having a dream, and it's hard to say. The text moves. Again, we're dealing with an English version of a Hebrew or Aramaic text, which doesn't have sentences, and it just kind of moves along. So it's very difficult, I think, sometimes. But he said, when I continued to watch, because of the boastful words of the horn, which is a power, was speaking, and I kept looking until the beast was slain, and its body destroyed, and threw a blazing fire. I think in this text, beasts are ideas and thoughts that should be thrown away and trashed. So I'll keep that in mind. And thrown into the blazing fire, and other beasts that were stripped of their authority and were not allowed to live for a period of time. Ideas and thoughts penetrate our hearts and minds, and we give them light and life. We give them a speaking voice, no matter what it is. We give them that voice. And so what he is saying, at some point in time, they're going to be stripped of their authority and not allowed to live. And they have to have beings to live in this case. And he said, in my vision that night, I looked, and there before me was one like the Son of Man, coming in the clouds, and he approached the Ancient of the Days and was led into his presence and was given authority, glory, sovereign power over all nations and peoples, and every language worshipped him. And his dominion is everlasting dominion and will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Within this text is where I say that Jesus, which is talking about a sovereign leader, a sovereign idea that it was going to reign in over the world. Now, when I say one, I do not mean a single thought, because one is both infinite and singular in my world of reality. So you can have a multitude of thoughts under one. God is one, meaning God is infinite, but also there is gods which are one. So you can have single thoughts and you can have a multitude of thoughts, and God is one, meaning that he is infinite. The Ancient of Days, to me, is a living memory of all history. That's how I take the Ancient of Days. That's how I incorporate the Ancient of Days, in case anybody was wondering what I think of Ancient of Days. It's like the Akasha records, the Akasha records we talk about. Somewhere there is a record in my understanding of God, in my reality, of how I understand the spiritual realms and what have you. There is a living memory in which of everything that ever happened. And I see the Ancient of Days as being that. Because, yes.
according to Jesus, which God impregnated Mary and was his real father?
You're talking about stumping the minister. It was the Spirit of God. It didn't say it was an individual or a being God. It said a spirit hovered over.
Well, what spirit of what God then?
Spirit of the Most High God. That's a good question. But I would say that it was the Spirit of God. It wasn't a being that came and manifested itself in a way. That's how I see it. The Spirit moved. It was an energy force. Okay, I'll use more common non-theological language. It was an energy force that moved upon Mary and manipulated her eggs and it became pregnant. And that's why I say Jesus was not totally human in the way that we understand the way we were born. We're not born by necessarily a Holy Spirit hovering over top of us. We're by male and female. We are by the egg and the sperm we are produced. And here comes a more complicated theological question of whether Jesus was just a human or divine or both. And that's down the line a little bit yet. We're not there yet. I don't want to get too far ahead. So what is the difference between the greatest law, Jesus said, and the Ten Commandments? Jesus said, if I can got it right here, I thought Mark here somewhere. Where is it? Oh yeah, here it is. The most important, the question was given to Jesus in Mark. I'm going to use Mark's 12:28. And the great leaders of the law came to Jesus, and they asked him this question for debate. And it says, one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating, noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, and he asked him, of all the commandments, which one is the most important? The most important one, Jesus says, is this: hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one. And it's not capitalized. That's important. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. And the second is to love your neighbor as yourself. There is no greater commandment than these. What was Jesus saying? In my world, the Israelite, the Jewish people were to love their God as one. But did Jesus say to them, love me with all your heart? Jesus didn't say that. He said, love the Lord thy God with all your heart. What is the Lord your God? It's what you believe and what you accept to be true and what you hold in your heart and which you give light and life to. That is the Lord your God. And if you can love your neighbor with what you're hold as your God, if you can love your neighbor the same as you love your idea, then you're doing what Jesus told you to do. Now, can you do that? Can you do that if you have a Calvinist point of view in which you say some are going to heaven and some are not, or predestination? Can you take that type of thought system and say, I'm going to love my neighbor as myself? No. Not in my world, you can't. Can you hate Muslims? Can you hate gay people? Can you hate any kind of group? No. You have to take the Lord your God, in which you hold true and dear to your heart, as being light and life, in which you're sitting on the hill, in which you give, and love your neighbor as yourself. If you can equate them two, then you're doing what Jesus said, the greatest commandment. What I am suggesting is the Ten Commandments does not allow you to do that. It says to love the Lord thy God, Israel's God. Another point that I can't understand is we are not supposed to kill. But what did Yahweh, the God of Israel, do? He drove them into the promised land and wiped out a whole bunch of people. He broke the very laws in which he commanded his people to do. How can they be for me when they benefit only the Israelite people at the time? I can't get that picture. I don't see love my neighbor in that. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not covet. Well, yes, Dan.
I figured it was like he was the only one allowed to do that. People that he didn't think belonged on earth, he could get rid of. We can't do that.
Well, is that the greatest commandment that Jesus gave us, to love our neighbor as ourselves?
No.
The two do not harmonize. I don't care how you try to mesh them together. How are you going to mesh them together? You can't. At least I can. And I say that he meant them only for the children of Israel, for the betterment of the Israelite people, and that's it. And so when people want to tell me I adhere to the Ten Commandments, I cringe. I want the Ten Commandments in the court of law, I cringe. I would rather see, and I have said this, I would rather see the greatest commandment. Love the Lord thy God with all that heart, mind, and soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. Now that really puts a lot of people under conviction, myself included, because I can't do that all the time, if ever. There is something in my mountain of thought in which I cast judgment or I have reservations about. I can't do it. To me, that is a big distinction between the two. One is for one God. Jesus was for all. How do I get one God out of this? Because your mountain on the hill, your mountain on the hill, and your mountain on the hill that you give light and life to, they all come together. If we are loving our neighbor as ourselves, we become one. We have the God of love, the God of humanity, the God of compassion. We're not a jealous people. We're not a jealous God. We don't serve a jealous God. We don't serve an envious God. We don't serve a wrathful God, which them are words that are used in the Old Testament God to describe that. We serve a loving God who has compassion. We can have different ways of thinking as long as we're loving our neighbor as ourselves and become one. And it becomes infinite. There was an article, I'm real close to the end. There was an article that someone sent me here out of the Sojourners magazine by Jim Wallace. And it was asked, the basic premise of it, of the title was, why does the hard right conservative wing control the narrative of Christianity? And within that article was that many of us are not hard right. There is a new progressive movement that thinks more in the middle and towards the left. But we don't have a voice. Only the radical right, religious right, gets to represent Christianity. And his article was about Mayor Pete, who is running for president. I'm not saying one way or another whether you should like him or dislike him, but the main article was about a lot of what this person had to say. And along with that was that he represented a more moderate middle left, and he thinks that we should have a voice. And I agree. I definitely agree. And I think the only reason, one of the main reasons that it gets a lot, the hard right gets, religious right gets a lot of attention, because they have a big voice. They can jump up and down more. And I think collectively we lack a collective effort to move forward in the progressive, more middle, and to promote. And I think the younger generation, as far as I'm concerned, is much more there than they are in the hard right. Yes, there's a lot of people who are hard right. There's no question about it. But I don't think Jesus necessarily lived there. I think Jesus lived in the middle. He was the cross, with the cross beam, both right and left. He stood in the middle and said, "Come unto me," as he hung on the cross. So ask yourself, What are you willing to give up? What are you willing to sacrifice to better love your neighbor as yourself?
Thank you.